Hi friends! A short message before we start the episode. Every time we meet a new scientist, we love to chat with him or her over a good coffee or tea. So if you like the show and want to support our work, here are two ways to do it. The first one is to go on our page, Buy Me a Coffee, by following the link in the show notes, and to offer us a coffee. Simple, effective, and we won't forget to thank you. The second way is just as simple. Just share your opinion about the episode on Twitter by tagging us at LonelyPipette. We won't miss to answer you. Thanks again for the sharing and à bientôt!
Very often people will think that philosophers do not interact with science. If they understand that philosophy can interact with science, they will think that it's going to happen at the end of the process. For example, people make sort of an experiment, sort of a discovery, and then philosophers might be useful to write a better paper, for example, you know, to find the good words, or to explain what is the big challenge behind the discovery, etc., etc. We think this is important, but we have seen by our sort of long experience now that we are much more useful if we intervene upstream. So if we participate in designing the experiment, for example, if we say we have this idea, would that be possible to implement that idea and make something that would be different from what other labs do in the world by testing this or testing that?
Are you working in research, trying to do the best science you can?
Are you a team leader, a research assistant, postdoc, PhD student, or any other type of scientist?
Are you looking for a place where you can sit, relax, and listen to inspiring people?
Well, we have good news for you. You've just found what you're looking for.
Hi everybody, my name is Renaud Pourpre.
And I am Jonathan Weitzman.
Welcome to the Lonely Pipette,
helping scientists
do better science.
My name is Thomas Pradeux. I work in the philosophy of science at the CNRS and the University of Bordeaux in France. And I must say, I feel very excited to share my tips with the Lonely Pipette Pipette.
Thank you, Thomas. So Thomas studied philosophy at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. He was a visiting fellow at Harvard University before embarking on a PhD on the philosophy of immunology with Jean Gaillon and Edgardo Carosella. He was an associate professor in philosophy at the University Paris-Sorbonne before joining the CNRS in 2014. He then moved to the University of Bordeaux and founded the Conceptual Biology and Medicine team, which was supported by an ERC starting grant to study the microbiome and biological individuality. His research, published in equally in Science and Philosophy of Science journals, deals with biological individuality and especially immunity-cancer interactions and immunity microbiome interactions. Thomas is the coordinator of the Philosophy in Biology and Medicine International Network, the PhilIn Biomed, and he was a CASBS fellow at Stanford University, California in 2020. Thomas, thanks for coming to share your tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very happy and excited to be here.
Yeah, you have to choose only one adjective. That's the that's really complicated. thank you, Thomas. It's an honor to have you in this podcast. You are, and you should be proud of this, you are the first philosopher we have in our podcast. We will talk more about this and discover a bit what you do. We believe it's going to be very interesting for our listeners. I'm usually asking always the same question. People should, or maybe they are bored of it, but I'm not, because it's a very important question for us. It's your origin story, like a superhero. So can you tell us how you decided to become a scientist?
Well, it's a very slow process, especially when indeed you start with philosophy and then go to science. So clearly there was something of a sort of tension in my mind when I was younger. I loved science and I loved philosophy. And as you know, in France, those two things are pretty different. So if you go to philosophy, you're kind of not necessarily anti-scientist, but different from a scientist. And then, so I did philosophy in a very traditional way, as Jonathan just said, at the École Normale Supérieure. And the aggregation, which is one of these crazy exams we have in France. And then I really decided to go back to science. That was very clear in my mind, especially when I chose immunology, because I loved immunology in terminal, so in high school. And I decided to really go back to immunology for two reasons. One was that I really liked that part of science. I thought it was super complex and super interesting because it was complex. And the second thing, to be honest, was that I was truly bored with the way philosophy is done in France, in the sense that philosophy is mainly about talking about other philosophers. So this is a very inward-looking discipline, and I think it wasn't for all its history, and it became something like that in the last maybe 100 years or so, and I really wanted to talk about something which was a big concept, but that would be related to the science. So that really what drove me to the science was really like using philosophy as a sort of entry point to then go back to science, and in my case, biology.
And if you hadn't become a philosopher or a scientist, what do you think you would have been?
This, I have no idea. I guess this is often an answer you get, in the sense that I think many of us are kind of predetermined in many senses. I have never thought about what else I could do, even though I don't come from a family where people are scientists or philosophers for that matter. It's just that it was there. And I've seen many people in the last years, I mean, recently, who are doing some academic work and then they decide to do something else. And often it's difficult for, even though they have an incredible number of, you know, things they can, their capacities are amazing. But I think many of us do that also because we don't see.
Can't do anything else.
and I'm sure it's wrong. It's just that, so I really can't answer that question. I think my experience is that I would have been happy in many different jobs. It's just that this is the one I chose, and I have very strong difficulties imagining myself right now doing something else. Also, because as you perfectly know, it's also a job of passion, and many jobs are jobs of passion, but that one is clearly one, and it's very difficult for me to answer that question. Sorry, I don't have a good answer to that.
So you've never thought of leaving and doing something else?
No. No. I was really, it was complex enough choosing, and in the end, I didn't have to make a choice, but choosing between philosophy and science, and also choosing between being a teacher in high school, which is the kind of normal fate of a philosopher in France, and doing some research. And in the end, I do all that, like, you know, teaching and doing research and philosophy and science, but really, navigating through this was difficult enough. And also, just imagine when you say you start a career in science, your family is normally a little bit happy about it, even though they can be unsure about what's going to happen to you. But just imagine when you say, I'm going to do philosophy. I mean, you know, my father is an engineer. So, and it's not exactly what people expect when you say, I'm going to do philosophy. So that was complicated enough to navigate. That, you know, I didn't have time to really think about another thing I could really do.
Great, thank you. So as I said at the beginning, you're the first philosopher working. So this is with biology, because I know that there is a, Jonathan told me just before that there is a difference between philosophy of and philosophy in biology. So maybe to clarify a bit what you're doing. And because we have the in this podcast we have the habits to decipher how we do science. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is it exactly that you do in your work?
Yeah, I mean,
my mum always says, tell me exactly what you do. So, and my mum is listening, Thomas. So make it understandable for my mum.
But I think it's a fair question for all of us, and especially in my case, because again, this is a little bit difficult to imagine from the outside what kind of things we philosophers can do for science, in science, with science. So yeah, so basically, I think that there is a long tradition of philosophy, of course, and there's a tradition within philosophy, which is to do philosophy of science. And philosophy of science is mainly thinking about science. So the object of philosophy of science is science. So for example, you're going to ask, what is a scientific explanation? how can we establish causality in science, the different ways of establish what a causality is, etc. Or you can think, what is a scientific theory? What is the difference between science and non-science? All that is part of philosophy of science, and this is super important. Within philosophy of science, we have other traditions which are more specialized. For example, philosophy of physics or philosophy of biology. So my field initially is philosophy of biology, and I'm still a philosopher of biology, obviously, so going to the conferences in philosophy of biology. So what do we do in philosophy of biology? We ask kind of the big questions about biology. For example, what is a gene? What are the different definitions of fitness? And what difference does it make to adopt one definition or another? So this field has different origins, but one important origin at the international level is the 1960s in the US mainly, where people really gathered and decided to create with biologists, in fact, philosophy of biology. So for example, Ernst Mayr, Dick Lewontin, these people were very instrumental in creating philosophy of biology as a field. And interestingly enough, philosophy of biology was built a little bit in tension with all the rest. So philosophers of biology did not really like analytic philosophy. So like the philosophy that asks the, you know, questions about just concepts in the abstract. They really wanted to do something that was close to the science. Also, they were a little bit skeptical on the what they called the imperialism of philosophy of physics. So they thought there is this idea that when you do philosophy of science, it's necessarily about physics because physics is supposed to be the queen of all sciences. And they decided to do something different. So I'm clearly part of that and a very big name in my field, of course, mostly unknown by scientists, but a very big name was David Hull, H-U-L-L, and he was really a philosopher involved in scientific work to the point that he became the president of the main American Society in Taxonomy, for example. So you see, he became sort of a scientist and a philosopher. So that is the general context. So then we decided some years ago to create a sort of subset within this subset. It's the idea that not to create it, rather to describe it, because it's been around for a long time. Among philosophers of science, some are philosophers in science. What does it mean? It simply means that in addition to talking about science and the way it is done and the way it is practiced and the big concept, they want to intervene into science. They want to be actors in the science. So what they do is to go to the scientists very often, or at least to the science, and they will get involved in the science. They will, for example, write a paper, which is a way of saying, you have been talking about that in science. I want to intervene in that debate, and I want to say something that will be relevant for you scientists. A great example of that is Elliot Sober. Of course, David Hull is also a good example of that. It's just that we are describing in our recent work, we have done some sort of descriptive work about what is philosophy in science. And the general idea is that you have some philosophers who say, I want to intervene in the science I'm talking about. And you might think that this is obvious and this is everyone, but no, some people don't think this is what philosophy should be about. They think philosophy should be about saying something about the science without pretending to offer anything like a proposal that might be interesting for the scientist. So philosophers in science, and our group is part of that, are people who want to intervene and they want to make a difference to the science. Do they succeed? Well, most of the time they don't, in the sense that this is very ambitious to say, you know, I'm going to the science and I'm going to make a difference, even a small difference, to the science. So in most cases, you fail as philosophers in science, but some of us believe that this is an important ambition that is the best way to really connect the philosophy and the sciences, because it means that you have to be assessed by the scientist to whom you want to talk. You know, they will say in the end, if you were useful or not. So that is why in the last years, and sorry, I'm a little bit general here, but I just want to emphasize that, for example, it was very important for me in the last 3 years to document very precisely what is going on for those philosophers who manage to be cited by scientists in a way that clearly shows that those scientists say, oh, Elliot Sober, for example, or Samuel Kasha, or they, Maureen O'Malley, many examples, they made a difference to the science by clarifying this or making that point, etc., etc. And a lot of what we've done recently is to, in a certain sense, ask the scientists who among the philosophers, who made a difference to your field? And that is a very big question.
Don't you think part of the problem is that they don't meet? So many biologists don't know any philosophers. So, and they don't read the journals. So if you were to say how many philosophers have influenced my work, very few, because I we don't meet, we don't go to the same conferences, we don't write and publish and read the same journals. So
that's perfect.
How do we overcome that?
Yeah, that's a very, so I think a lot of what we're talking about is really ignorance, in the sense that philosophers know that scientists are around. Scientists often don't know, I mean, they know that philosophy exists, but they have no idea that some philosophers work in philosophy of science, and even less so that some philosophers would be interested in intervening in science. So a big, big problem is sort of mutual ignorance, or that kind of ignorance we're talking about. A second problem, I think, is that philosophy of science has itself become very specialized. So for example, if someone, a biologist, comes and say, okay, I do biophysics, tell me what I should read in philosophy of biophysics. And I would be able, I think, with a lot of effort, to find maybe 3 papers in total. So that means that it's very likely that that scientist, you know, who made the effort of asking what's going on in philosophy of biophysics, and the answer will be very disappointing because the numbers are going to be very small. So that's the second problem.
I can attest to that. I've been looking for a philosopher of parasitology for several years, and we haven't yet found one.
And this is a great example, because it's even more the case that we should have. I mean, biophysics is fantastic, super interesting, but clearly parasitology also has all sorts of implications at the medical level, also sort of very fascinating set of questions in terms of what is a parasite, what is not a parasite, when do you move. So these questions have been tackled by some philosophers, but not specifically. So for example, I know some philosophers of virology. I don't know any philosophers of parasitology, and because I'm kind of specialized in immunology, I wouldn't know them if they existed. So that's the second problem. The second problem is that philosophers of biology have focused on evolution and on some questions in evolution. And it's great because they made fantastic progress sometimes on some of these questions. So I think that was great. One of my fights in the last 10 years or so has been to say, without changing anything to the importance of philosophy of evolution within philosophy of biology, we need to add different topics, different questions that are very important. And in 2017, I wrote a paper, to be honest, a little bit unnoticed, that is a very specific comparison between what is published in the journal Biology and Philosophy, which is kind of the flagship journal in philosophy of biology. It's been there since 1986, and it was created by Michael Ruse. You know, so the whole community reads that journal. And I made a comparison between the biological topics, which are examined in biology and philosophy, and during exactly the same years, the biological topics examined in the PNAS, so the Proceeding of the National Academy of Science. And the gaps are super interesting. So basically, it's a sort of 60% of evolution in biology and philosophy, and about 5% in PNAS. And the 95% of the rest can be philosophically very interesting and very relevant. So we have this gap, which I think is very important. And the third aspect, I think, about what you were saying, Jonathan, is really that there is a skepticism from scientists. So some scientists do make the effort of having a look about what's going on in philosophy. They find some people who work. So they find their sort of philosopher of parasitology. So they find it, for example, in philosophy of physics or in philosophy of quantum mechanics. And they do the effort, and then they say, oh no, it's not working. Or they don't do the work, and they assume that the work is not useful. So I've worked quite a lot on that. So for example, Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize in Physics, read quite a lot of philosophy of physics and then said, okay, it doesn't work. I mean, and he said something which is often quoted, which is that he says, I don't know any physicist after the Second World War whose work has been influenced in any significant way by philosophers of science. And this is a very big claim that is not very encouraging for us. Fortunately, other people have said very different things. You know, Einstein said, for example, that history and philosophy of science was absolutely crucial for physics. So we have this sort of fight within the sciences where scientists often ignore philosophy. And when they hear about philosophy, they are often very skeptical on the possibility for philosophers to be useful for the science.
So could I ask just in order to try to really push this, because I don't know about philosophy. I'm not skeptical. I'm absolutely hugely curious about that, because I believe that it could be another tool to help scientists. Could you give us an example, for example, that you have seen that how a philosopher, you or something that you have seen, have helped a scientist in that way?
Yeah, there are many different ways. One of the most frequent and one that works often very well is intervening in a controversy where things are in fact unclear. So one of the big successes of people like David Hall or Elliot Sober or Samuel Kasha, people are already mentioned before, was to intervene into the debate over units of selection. So there was this debate, very important debate about units of selection and group selection in evolutionary biology in the 1960s and 1970s. And what David Hall, for example, did was to say, okay, you have to be super clear on what you mean by a unit of selection. And he suggested two different concepts, the concept of replicator and the concept of interactor. So the words do not matter that much, but the idea is very important. He said, when, for example, you want to create a fight between, I don't know, Ernst Mayr and Richard Dawkins, and indeed these people were really fighting, and he says, okay, are you talking about a unit of selection in the sense of an entity that makes copies of itself? In that case, you're talking about a replicator. And the best example of a replicator is certainly a gene. So it makes sense to talk about the selfish gene, or at least to talk about the gene as a unit of selection. Or are you talking about the entity which is the target of the action of natural selection? In that case, you're talking about an interactor. That is what Ernst Mayr was describing as what is being seen by evolution. So evolution, most of the time, will act on organisms, and these are paradigmatic examples of interactors. And for example, if you read the huge book by Stephen Jay Gould, it's more than 3,000 pages, published in 2002, and he says, over more than one page, he says, probably the person who did the best work to clarify this question and show us that we were in fact talking past each other, there was this confusion, we were not talking about the same thing. And thanks to David Hall, we started to be able to see our differences in a very productive and interesting way. So often science creates controversies, and controversies are very useful. And some of these controversies are in fact in need of clarification. And many philosophers have done that. And David Hall and the other people I mentioned are examples of that. So this is an example that was really kind of important for philosophy of biology, because it sort of it sets the standards of the kind of things that we can do in the in the field. So of course, then I could give you more examples from our lab, but I think it's better to give you an example which is very famous in the field and which is not an example from us, because I have less biases talking about David Hall than I have talking about our own work.
So to come to your work, you chose immunology, and you set up your team. You called the team Conceptual Biology and Medicine. So what is it? What does the team look like, and how does that? How do you integrate? So the team has both philosophers and biology doing philosophy and biology in the same lab. How does that work? What does it look like?
Yeah, so we are part of a lab which has become pretty big now. So the lab is called Immunoconcept. So sometimes people believe that I chose the name and I'm the head of the lab. No, the lab is a pretty big immunology lab. So we are a little bit more than 100 at the moment. So it's not a huge lab, but it is a big lab. And my team, I mean, the team I co-lead with Maëlle Lemoine now, is by far the smallest team in the lab. So we have four teams in total, and our team, I think, has 12.
So all the other teams are doing classic immunology.
Exactly. So we have a team mainly working on the vulnerability of the immune system, on aging, and on gamma delta T cells. We have a team working on autoimmune diseases, a third team working on oncoimmunology, so cancer and immunology. And the fourth team, the smallest team by far, we are 12, I think, is the team of philosophers and conceptual biologists, where we have at the moment one MD, I think, and I think at the moment only one or two biologists. Sorry, I'm confused because the group is changing quite fast, and also the lab is changing quite fast. But, you know, Lily, the idea is to have an interdisciplinary team, which is really embedded in the immunology lab. So what do? We participate in basically all the activities of the lab. We go to the weekly seminars are purely about immunology. We go to some, many lab meetings or group meetings, et cetera, and we are really part of the lab. So if you in front of my office, you have some L2, so you have some labs, so we are in constant interactions. One thing that we try to do, which is very important, is to intervene in science upstream. So that's one of the main ideas that we think are very important. Very often, people will think that philosophers do not interact with science. If they understand that philosophy can interact with science, they will think that it's going to happen at the end of the process. For example, people make sort of an experiment, sort of a discovery, and then philosophers might be useful to write a better paper, for example, to find the good words, or to explain what is the big challenge behind the discovery, et cetera, et cetera. We think this is important, but we have seen by our sort of long experience now that we are much more useful if we intervene upstream. So if we participate in designing the experiment, for example, if we say we have this idea, would that be possible to implement that idea and make something that would be different from what other labs do in the world by testing this or testing that? So we've done quite a lot of that. And especially, I must mention this sort of institutional aspect, which I think is absolutely crucial. In the last years, I've supervised students who are biologists, and that was great. So what we do when a biologist wants to work with me, we co-decide what the exact topic is, and then I find a co-supervisor who is a scientist, if possible in the lab, because it's much better, if not possible, then elsewhere than our lab. And we co-supervise that student in a way that forces us to interact and forces us to be productive by intervening upstream in the science and deciding together what to do in the science. So I can be more concrete here. Recently, I had a student. She was great, coming from biology, interested in all sorts of questions in history and philosophy of science. And what we did was to work on the old hypothesis in cancer biology, which is called the seed and soil hypothesis. And the seed and soil hypothesis was framed at the end of the 19th century by Stephen Paget in the UK. And he said, basically, we tend to think of cancer as a question of seed. So you have these cancer cells or cancer something, and they disseminate in the body depending on their attributes, the attributes of the cells. And he said we should pay as much attention probably to the soil than just to the seed. We should pay attention to why, for example, some tumors are going to disseminate rather to this organ rather than to this organ rather than to that organ. And he said probably some soils are more congenial, he says, than others to sort of welcome this metastasis in the metastatic process. And this idea was a little bit forgotten until the 1980s, where Fiedler, among others, but Fiedler played had a very important role there, because he thought he had a great idea, and then he found out that there was this paper by Paget, and he said, "Oh, the guy, you know." And he also said something which I really like, which is to say that in the Jewish tradition, you never invent something. You always find something that has already been said by someone else. And he was like, "Oh, no, that's the way it works." So he talked about Paget, and really, like, Paget made a return into biology, but not so much in immunology. So what we did was to say, okay, what kind of new... First, we tried to clarify what Paget wanted to say, and the way Paget's hypothesis has been reinterpreted in the 1980s and 1990s. And we showed that there was kind of several gaps here. So what Paget said was not exactly what scientists said he had said. And it's always like that. When people use history of science, I mean, it's part of their history to make a point, always they transform what the initial scientists say. That's perfectly normal, but that it's important to document. And then what we did was to think about new possible experiments we could do in immunology to see to what extent the seed and soil hypothesis could be revisited by immunological work. So what we did was to co-supervise with my friend and colleague Nicolas Larmonnier, a specialist of cancer immunology in the lab. We co-supervised Alina, the student I was talking about before, and we decided to design experiments where the question was, to what extent can immune cells make a soil more congenial for the arrival of metastatic cells than the soil would normally be The idea is very simple. It's the fact that perhaps some immune cells arrive in the metastatic site before the site is even metastatic. And it makes the site more metastatic or more prone to the arrival of metastatic cells than the organ would be. So it's a sort of a little bit counterintuitive, because people usually think of the immune system as something that would prevent cancer initiation and cancer progression. But as you know, in fact, the immune system has two very different roles here, often helping the cancer and in other cases preventing the progression and dissemination of cancer. So we designed some experiments in mice where we really tried to show that this effect existed. It's tough. It's very tough in the sense that we have not had one experiment that would be like, you know, the crucial experiment, as we say in philosophy of science. But still, I think we made good progress and the experimental paper is on its way. And, you know, it's an example where you start with historical and conceptual questions and then you turn that into something that you can sort of test or I at least implement into an experimental model that is available in the lab.
That's great. So I mean, you make a convincing argument. Do you think that maybe all biology labs could benefit from having an in situ philosopher?
I think overall it's probably a good idea to have some philosophers. Then I would say it really depends on many factors, including the kind of knowledge that those philosophers have of what's going on in the lab. So both the discipline in general and also the specificities of each lab, because it's simply not true that a lab in parasitology will be the same as another lab in parasitology. You will see differences in the topics, in the questions. So you have to be familiar with what's going on in the lab. That's super important. You also have to have some biologists who are open-minded. They do not have to be exposed to philosophy in the past. They have to be open-minded, a little bit in the way, Renaud, you said before, you know, I'm often interested in seeing new things, and that is extremely important. So never send a philosopher in the lab where at least the PI and, if possible, several other people in the lab are open-minded.
You have to prepare for the seeding.
Exactly. And I would really,
it fits very well with your metaphor of the immune cells that prepare
so maybe what we could do is to send, you know, philosophers like me just for 1 week and check if the lab is ready to welcome.
Thomas, we're doing it here. We're preparing the ground seeding philosophers.
You're right.
I mean, that's a kind of question I had, because now that I'm working in science communication, I see that sometimes institutes open the gates to artists, like some kind of residence, we say in French. I don't know how we say it in English, but
residence
too. So it's like 1-2 weeks, 1 month, 3 months open gates for those to discover. I can hear for what you said that it's difficult to have consultant consultant philosopher for labs, because you need to know what happened in the lab. But have you heard of this kind of, I don't know, residence for philosopher?
Yes, in fact, it exists, and this is very interesting, and it's also a little bit different, exactly for the reason that you just said. It's a little bit different from what I was talking about, in the sense that, in that case, what you can do is really to build, for example, a case study, a scientific case study that will be very useful for your philosophical work. For example, there is a trend in recent philosophy of science called philosophy of science in practice. And a lot of these people, what they did was to go to science labs and they used the lab in a certain sense to make observations and to make a point about philosophy of science or a practical point about how science works, etc., etc. For them, it's very relevant to go to the lab in sort of residency and spend there 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Often they will make interviews, etc., etc. But pay attention to the fact that most of the time they don't want to do science. They want to
sort of anthropology.
It's closer to anthropology. And indeed, the philosophers of science in practice I have in mind, they've learned quite a lot about ethnology, anthropology, you know, all these fields, because these fields are used to do that. You know, they have a long experience in doing that. So they've learned quite a lot in the social sciences, anthropology, etc., to do that very well. And I think their work is super interesting. But most of the time, it's different in the sense that they don't want to publish a paper in a science journal with scientists. They want to do their own work and to study what's going on in that scientific lab. I forgot to say something which is obvious for me, but not obvious at all, probably. Our main activity is to publish papers in science journals. So what we do is to publish more than 70% of our papers are in science journals. And what difference does it make? Well, it's a huge difference, because instead of talking to your colleagues in philosophy of science and to be evaluated by editors and reviewers in philosophy of science, you are evaluated by editors and reviewers in science. So you send a paper which is anonymous, nobody knows you're a philosopher or part of a group of philosophers, and you submit that to a science journal and they will assess your work on that. So you see, it's completely different. Residency will not do, in the sense that, I mean, residency will do if, for example, if I go in residency to another immunology lab, that can work very well because I know already immunology and I'm already part of an immunology lab. But the kind of work I was talking about before, for example, co-supervising a PhD in biology with a biologist, requires very long-term work. And to be honest, the kind of things that we do, the kind of things that Lucie Laplan does at Gustave Roussy, another philosopher you might want to invite one day, the kind of work we do requires absolutely long-term work and a very good knowledge of the science we are talking about. So we have to be able to participate in lab meetings and say something about the science that is relevant for the scientists.
So Tom, I know we've discussed this in the past. Do you think philosophers would consider that you have abandoned your philosophical culture and that actually you're just an immunologist?
Yes. In fact, this is always very difficult, because you are always fighting, when you're in my position, you're always fighting with the kind of ignorance and skepticism on the side of scientists that we talked about before. So you always have to make you a little bit visible, not super visible, but a little bit visible, so that they know that you exist. And then you have to fight the kind of skepticism, which I think is a very healthy skepticism. You know, I don't think we should say philosophy is constantly and massively useful to the science. We have to constantly show why and how, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have to fight, I mean, fight maybe is too strong a word, but you are confronted with those philosophers who say, if you succeed in intervening into science, then ipso facto, you cease to be a philosopher. And that, I think, is not true. And I think that, just to go back to the example of David Hall once again, I think we have a great example of someone who is a wonderful philosopher and a wonderful scientist together. Mm-hmm. In which sense, the methodologies that we use are mostly philosophical methodologies. And just think about the work of David Hall, or my work, much more minor, but on individuality. I mean, individuality is clearly one of the most important questions of philosophy. It's a massive question for Aristotle, for example. And Aristotle constantly uses biology as a way to address the question of individuality. And many people have proved that the metaphysics of Aristotle on individuality, in fact, is dependent on his thinking on organisms. You know, Aristotle was a wonderful biologist. I mean, it's easy to make fun of what he did, but he was a very important biologist. And in a certain sense, what we do is to just continue this tradition. Maybe we are clearly less good and less important than Aristotle, but we continue this tradition in which philosophy is about the world. Philosophy is not about talking about other philosophers. I mean, Aristotle talks a little bit about other philosophers, maybe 2% of his time, and the 98% is to create something about what is the world like, and he wants to intervene in the description of the world. And this is exactly what we do. I think the problem is on the side of philosophers, not on our side. We are just continuing a tradition which is very long. Philosophy in the 19th century started to be talking just about philosophers, and no great philosopher of the past has done that. So we are continuing the tradition of philosophy. They have studied something different, which is that philosophy should be about philosophers. And I think this is not true.
You made me think of a slide that I often used at the beginning of the semester, where I quote Francis Bacon, who asks, what is a scientist? Is it a doer or a thinker? And he has the metaphor of the ant, the spider, and the bee.
Yeah.
So, and obviously you have to be a doer and a thinker to be a scientist.
Exactly. And I think we can be part of that if everyone understands what role we can have as philosophers in this general question. And then it raises the question of a sort of division of labor between philosophers and scientists. I think that is something which is very important. But to go back to the question, do we need philosophers everywhere? I would say it really depends. as I said before. And also, increasingly, in the last 6 months or so, I've started to think that the real question is, what role should foundational thinking play in science? And I, by foundational thinking, I mean the sort of reflection about the conceptual, theoretical, and methodological foundations of science. What I mean by that is that some scientists do that, and they do that very well. I mean, in a certain sense, when Einstein promotes philosophy, he doesn't really promote philosophers. He says, as a scientist, I know that I need to think about concepts, and I need, for example, to redefine entirely the concept of mass, or time for that matter, because it is important to change. So I think in science, there is this sort of, there is a subset of scientists who are truly both doers and thinkers. And what they want to do is to change the foundations of the discipline. This is very ambitious, very arrogant. Some manage to do so. Einstein is a great example, of course. Others don't. And I think philosophers should be understood as part of this process rather than as a sort of autonomous group. I mean, if we can do something, I believe, it is to make clear to the scientists that foundational thinking is part of science and is very important. If in the end, that work is not done by professional philosophers, I don't care that much. I just happen to think that if science forgets the importance of foundational thinking, then it's going to lose a very important aspect of what it does and what it should do.
How can a biologist, if someone wants, of course, how can a biologist start publishing in philosophy and start doing the, is that possible?
I
guess it's not easy, but
it's not easy, but it has been done in the past. So there are two aspects in your question. One is how a biologist could work closely with a philosopher and publish together a co-authored paper. That's a very important question, and that does not have to be in a philosophy journal. Very often, the philosophers who want to interact with scientists want to publish in science journals. So this is one type of collaboration where there, the question will be, what is the added value of philosophy and why would I want to co-author a paper with a philosopher? We have soon, very soon, a summer school about philosophy in biology and medicine, where this is exactly the question that we ask to our philosophers and scientists who are going to be participants in this summer school. And indeed, we have now quite a good number of examples where scientists decided to co-write with a philosopher because they thought they needed a clarification or a different question, etc., etc. Then the other question is, to what extent some biologists could publish in philosophy journals? And of course, there, this has existed for a long time. And the journal I was mentioning before, Biology and Philosophy, for example, publishes, I think, about 20% of the papers are written by biologists. And the initial papers, when the journal was launched, many of them were written by scientists. So exactly the biologist I was mentioning before, Ernst Mayr, Dick Lewontin, Francisco Ayala, you know, all these people played a very important role in launching philosophy of biology. And for example, if you take an issue of Biology and Philosophy, recently you will find the names, I mean big names, Rick Michaud, for example, big name in evolution in Arizona. I mean, those people sometimes decide to publish, John Maynard Smith published before, you know, his death, published several papers in Philosophy of Science journal. So very big names in the field sometimes, often because we ask them, to be honest, but also because sometimes they feel the need to say something more conceptual than they usually do, will publish in those journals. So it's perfectly doable. Mm-hmm. The only question is, to what extent are you going to raise a sort of a big picture question about your field? So if you have something very specific to say about one particular parasite or the process of the epigenetics in that parasite, it's not for a philosophy journal. But if you say, I'm really trying to think what is the demarcation criterion between, for example, symbiosis and being a parasite, or if you want to say those things are perfect for a philosophy journal that has some interest in science. So the only problem then is, to what extent do scientists want to do something like that? You have to know that one of the highest impact factor in philosophy is about 2 or 2.5, I think. So a very big obstacle is to... So that's also why it's often already very well established and famous scientist. Because for a young person, you know, it's a little bit costly to publish in a philosophy journal. It takes time. And in terms of career, it's not that obvious. So I would say it's also something to think about with people like me and many others who are used to that kind of interactions.
And you have to find a collaborator, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, sometimes, as I said, sometimes scientists published in those journals on their own. So, you know, there are papers of, it's just that you have to think that you have a sort of big picture question that will be of interest to the philosophers. But you're right, often people will try to find a collaborator, and then they will try to find if there is a philosopher of parasitology or anything like that, and then they might be a little bit disappointed. But this is something we're working on.
So can you tell us a little bit about how important mentors were along the way, the people who mentored you? Were your mentors more biologists or philosophers? And what did you pick up from them that you then use in your team now?
Yeah, so it's clearly, it was very important for me to have mentors. Clearly, Jean Gaillon, so my PhD supervisor, was absolutely central in my thinking. Jean Gaillon was one of the main philosophers of evolutionary biology, very well known as a philosopher and historian of evolution across the world. And he was very welcoming when I said I want to work on immunology, even though that was not his main domain of expertise. Jean was incredibly supportive and very important in my career, and also a very good friend and someone you could always talk to, and who was always very good to make the relevant critiques at the relevant moment. So, you know, those people are very important, and they play a crucial role in your life. So that was very important.
Jean was the one who convinced me that I should be brave enough to go to a philosophy conference and give. Speak wow. with him on the stage.
He was fantastic as a person, as a philosopher, and also he himself went through a phase where he was not convinced anymore that philosophy was what he wanted to do. So he did a master in genetics, a very difficult master in genetics in Jussieu, back then. And he was really someone who associated very strongly and really combined philosophy and science. And I know many scientists who have read papers or books. The main book by Jean is absolutely excellent. I mean, those people have been instrumental in connecting philosophy and science. So that was clearly a very important person for me. I was also supervised by Edgardo Carosella for my PhD, who also played a very important role in explaining to me aspects of immunology. We worked together on the concept of immunological tolerance in many different situations, including why a mother will not eliminate the fetus immunologically. So we worked on all sorts of questions like that, and that was very important. Before my PhD, I went to Harvard, as you said, Jonathan, before, and there I worked with Dick Lewington. I mentioned him before, so one of the biggest names in population genetics, and Dick Lewington was very interested in philosophy, and he was very helpful, really very important for me. He was in my a PhD committee, and was really someone that had a huge influence on me. And also at Harvard, so again, before my PhD, I met Peter Godfrey-Smith, and Peter Godfrey-Smith is one of the main philosophers of biology now in Sydney, and he was a professor at Harvard. I was very lucky because he became a professor at Harvard the very year I arrived there, so I was very lucky, and we had great interactions, and this is, again, someone that, you know, who was very important for me. There would be many others, you know, because I had many interactions with Eric Vivier, one of the main immunologists in France.
What about your mentoring practice? How is it inspired by these people?
I think that the difference is that the people I'm talking about did not have the same kind of duties that I decided was my duty, which is really to create people, co-create with them people who are equally philosophers and biologists. I mean, they did that, of course, they did that, but in the lab, we implement that in a way which is different. So I'm constantly inspired by these people, and also trying to think, you know, in a certain sense, I believe that we are trying to realize something that is important for them or was important for them, and we are trying to push that project a little bit farther, and with all the risks, and the risks are mainly for the young, I mean, not for me. So this is something which is constantly in my mind. What kind of risks are the young people who work with us exposed to? We constantly talk about that in the team. I mean, the old guys in the team, we talk about that. What do we do? What kind of risks, et cetera, et cetera. I think in a certain sense, we are realizing that project. And I think this is the best way to honor these people that, you know, who were so important for me. At the same time, we are taking a risk. And I'm always thinking, you know, what would Jean do in a situation where someone, for example, realizes that she's not completely happy with what's going on, you know, because the kind of things we do are very difficult. So they inspire me not just because my career, of course, is very much a sort of a continuation of what they did, but also because I've decided to try to do something which I think was there in their mind, and we're trying to implement it in practice. And Jonathan, you mentioned before the Philin Biomed Network, so Philosophy in Biology and Medicine Network. And this is also a way of telling you that what we do in the lab is just one example, maybe a radical one, of something which has become bigger, because I think now we have 140 individual members in the Philin Biomed Network, mainly leading scientists in their fields. And we are trying to really implement that in different places. We have 12 institutional members in the Philin Biomed Network. So I just, you know, can give you one example in Utah, for example, in Utah, which is part of the network, they do the same kind of things that we're trying to do. And we are trying to learn from experience, also always trying to think the people who trained us, who supervised us, what exactly would they do, or how would they deal with that kind of situation. So you see, it's really there in our mind, even though the kind of things that we do is, I think, different in practice.
So I've tried some interdisciplinary work myself, and I know how challenging it can be, and also how satisfying it can be. This has been great, Thomas. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll hear more about the philosopher outside of the lab.
Hey, folks, don't run away. You're listening to The Lonely Pipette with Renaud Pourpre and Jonathan Weissman, where our goal is to help scientists do better science.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more, you can follow us on Twitter at Lonely Pipette. And please share the podcast with your friends.
If you don't want to miss any of our future episodes, you can subscribe to our mailing list and join our community. Click on the subscription link on our Twitter account.
It's as simple as that. Take a few moments to get more tips from The Lonely Pipette. Welcome back. The Lonely Pipette is talking to a philosopher for a change. And after the break, we want to hear more about how the philosopher thinks, and particularly about how you live your life. So do you have a philosophical morning routine? How does the day start?
So basically, as I think many other people, what I do is to read and write, especially write in the mornings, because I know that the afternoons are going to be completely busy with the rest of the work in the lab. So very often I write in the morning and as early as I can, and sometimes I work from home or from a library, because I know that being in the lab is both great and also being constantly disturbed by good questions, and that will make you it makes things much more difficult when you want to write. So yeah, very often my day is a little bit organized like that, and we try to put all the sort of group activities in the afternoon. Of course, COVID had some consequences on our work, as on the work of everyone else, but we're trying to organize our team this way. And we are a very international team. So one thing which is great is that we're very international. So the interactions in the afternoon are often, you know, of course, in English, and also with all sorts of people having different perspectives and experience. So yeah, that's basically the way it's done. And also, I necessarily spend at least 15 minutes per day reading a book. So that is very philosophical. This is something I, you know, sometimes more, but at least 15 minutes a day reading a book. So at the moment, I'm reading a book called The Genesis of Cancer, which is just a history of oncology book. And I try to do that also to remain a philosopher. I mean, philosophers read books, so I want to read books.
Okay, so who's that? That's by
the author is called Rather, I think, and it's a book which is already a little bit old, and it's really like the history of cancer from antiquity to today. So it's a it's a big perspective book. But this was just to give you an example of something I'm doing.
So apart from the reading, which isn't surprising, what is something an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
You mean in my daily life?
Yeah.
Something that would be different from what scientists usually do, you mean?
Yeah. Or something that people will be surprised to discover about you.
I guess I will...
That you can share.
Well, that is not the problem. I was really trying to find something rather than something that I would be happy to share. No, I mean, I think, it's a little bit sad to say. No, I think nothing very special, I think. I'm sorry. I'm not saying that my life is boring. Certainly not. It's not boring, but it's very well organized and it's very classic, I guess.
For a philosopher
of immunology.
Yeah. I mean, maybe what is less classic is the topic I chose, but the way I do it, I guess. I mean, I'm trying to think. One thing, but this is not a good answer to your question. One thing is just going back to this idea that one thing that we do is to constantly try to challenge the foundations rather than confirm the foundations. So this is something that is not something I do 10 minutes a day, for example. It's something I do constantly. The idea being that...
Do you do that at home as well? Are you always challenging everything?
Well... You mean like the family and all the rest?
Yeah. Do the dishes? Do you have to, is there a big conceptual discussion every time you have to do the dishes?
Not anymore, because my older daughter, who is almost 17, does that very well. So when you have someone challenging anything in the house, you don't need another person doing it. So I guess I transmitted that very well to my daughters. They do challenge things, and that is not something I want to add more to, you know, in terms of challenges. So no, I try to do that at work rather than at home.
So can you think about an activity outside of science that has impacted your work?
Clearly some sort of some very special activity I've done a lot in the past, but I could not mention for your previous question because it's not really part of my life anymore, just a little bit. Is role-playing games. So I've done role-playing games, so the kind of Dungeons and Dragons things. I've done that since I've been like 7 or 8, and I'm now 44, so it's a long time. So it's been really something important for me because it is about imagination, and from this point of view, it's extremely different from science because it's mainly about imagination, but it's also a very verbal game in the sense that you constantly say what your character is doing in the story. So it's very good for imagination and also very good for interactions. And for someone pretty shy initially like me, it was very important to use language as the main means through which I'm going to do my activity. And clearly today, for example, a huge difference between me and a scientist is that I talk rather than I would do experiments, for example, in the lab. You know, I don't do that. I help people to design their experiment, etc. So language, of course, is important for all philosophers, but has been very important for me. Unfortunately, I mean, interestingly enough, I kept some of my old friends playing role-playing games all these years, but we managed to meet and play once a year, which is absolutely ridiculous because I used to play constantly. All my weekends were about that. So that's part of my secret life, if you wish. And I think that had some impact on my thinking in science and also as a philosopher as well.
Wow, great. So you're reading, you were playing role play games, you're traveling, you're meeting people. So how do you balance your work and your personal life? Is there a secret tip from a philosopher?
No, unfortunately, I would love to know. If in previous discussions you had, it's clearly challenging. I think I have this difficulty of also because part of the work in philosophy and philosophy of science, and I think part of the work is better done at home than in the lab, as I said before. For example, very careful reading, very careful writing is not that easy to do in the lab. So that means that if you start working from home, home becomes a place where you work. And that has all sorts of consequences on the fact that as many scientists and philosophers, I tend to have very strong difficulties saying, I stop working at that moment, you know, in that place at that moment, et cetera, et cetera. I know this is a very common thing. I'm just saying that this is something I suffer from, and also, you know, people around me can suffer from. I think this is very difficult. And I think I cannot work entirely in the lab. I think people who manage to do that, it's much better. But even though they bring work home, they know they shouldn't. They know it should not be the place where they're supposed to work. And there's nothing like that for me. And that is really a problem. So in terms of balance, I think it's complicated. I think, and also my partner is also in the academic world. So it makes all, you know, we manage to organize pretty well in terms of, you know, when she goes somewhere, I will stay home and manage the, you know, and deal with the kids and all what you have to do in that. But I mean, that kind of balance, I think, is one of the most important questions for all of us in the academic world. And I also think that we need to change our expectations from this point of view. I think we have expected too much from the young. I think they want something different in terms of life balance. And I think they're right. And we are not too good to deal with that because we come from a period where things were different. Just a very clear example, very well known. Philosophy has a huge problem of gender. Philosophy is one of the worst fields in the world in terms of gender balance. It is absolutely normal for philosophy department to say, oh, let's meet on a Saturday morning, or let's meet at 6, from 6 to 8 p.m. in the afternoon. And that is crazy. And I mean, I try to fight a little bit against that, but I'm also part of the problem. I think we really need to keep the idea that, of course, when you commit yourself to that kind of job, you have to work. Of course, it's a lot of work. It's very demanding. But we have to do something much better than what I think we have achieved, my generation, in terms of work balance. So it's not a precise answer. It's just that I think I'm very open to the critique that the way we are doing it is not right, and we need to find something better. So a very vague answer, but this is something...
I can hear your 17-year-old daughter speaking.
Yeah, you see?
And my 17-year-old son. So.
Yeah.
So, can you think of an individual, either real or fictional, that has particularly inspired your life and your work, or your work?
So it's a little bit repetitive in a sense, but I think that... Dick Lewington, whom I mentioned before, I think was extremely influential on me, as he were on many other people. So I'm not saying here there is anything special. When you meet that kind of person who is so clever, so knowledgeable, so open to really to you as a person. So, I mean, when you are Dick Lewington, you could imagine that you would just talk about your work and, you know, and say the same things again and again. Instead, he was someone who would really listen to you and pay attention to what you're saying and try to help you building something. I mean, that kind of person, I mean, that is fantastic to meet those people. And I very often, he died recently, as you know, and recently we had a sort of festschrift, gathering people who knew him and worked with him. And that was great. So yeah, it's not very original probably, but that is the kind of person that, you know, who was, extremely influential on me, also because he was involved in society. He was politically involved. He was writing for the New York Review of Books. I don't do that, but I admire that. I really admire that. And I think that he was incredibly successful in doing all that together. And I think it's a model from this point of view that I would love to, I will never be able to do that, but I think it is a wonderful model for me to keep in mind.
Great.
So if you had $100 million or euros to spend in science, how would you spend them? But not an experiment, because we also know that you
don't do experiments.
I don't do experiments myself, though I would have some ideas in terms of spending the money for experiments. But yeah, I mean, more generally, I think I would definitely implement something like a sort of Institute for Advanced Studies. So a little bit, so where I was at Caspers last year, it is one of those Institute for Advanced Studies. I would do one that would be definitely centered on foundational thinking in science, as I said before, which is in a way what some Institute for Advanced Study do, you know, in Princeton and other places. But I would do something where, because the money, you know, would be there, I think, let's assume that the money is not taken from people who need it very much. You know, let's assume it's a fictional scenario where we can imagine that that money is well spent by trying a sort of world level experiment where we would have three or four places in the world, in different parts of the world, and we would say, okay, let's do it. Let's really try to implement more foundational thinking in science, in different sciences. And let's ask some philosophers, but also some mathematicians, some people who are theoreticians, let's put them together and we give to these people 5 years and we say, you can do whatever you want. And in the end, we see the kind of things you've come up with and we see if we can ask another 100 million or whatever to continue the I would really love to do that because my feeling is that many scientists know that science as it is currently done is great, but also faces of all sorts of problems. You know, deluge of data without necessarily the time to think about the data, without necessarily having the kind of frameworks that will really make sense of the data, etc. So I do think that many scientists feel the need for that. And with the money you're talking about, I would really try to implement that kind of things and see how it works.
Okay, great. So can I ask the question the other way around? If you were to have, can you think of a purchase of less than 100 euros that has impacted your life?
Well, I mean, philosophy mostly works with no money at all. So, so
water, a bottle of water.
I mean, we don't need much. So what kind of, yeah, I mean, then it could be, you know, the kind of, people I met, etc. So going back to that. So that is really something which is not costly and, you know, and had a huge impact. So I don't know. So, I mean, again, because I've been lucky enough to be given quite a lot of money for philosophers. So you mentioned the ERC project but I do think we use the money quite well, but I also think that as mathematicians and a few others, we can do good work without money. So, you know, that I think is a huge difference because the kind of question you're asking is, I think, very challenging for a biologist who does experiments, because in that case, you need a little bit of money. In my case, there are many things I could do with a very small amount of money or no money at all.
So. Could you identify an apparent failure that set you up for a later success?
I guess the kind of intervention into science that I did had to be a failure at first. First, because I was not probably good enough in what I was doing, and also because scientists are incredibly conservative, and I think many of them are skeptical with regard to philosophy. So, just to give you one example, when I started to work on a philosophy of immunology, I think I had some failure. So, for example, I remember someone writing a paper which was basically saying something like, with philosophers like that, don't be surprised that immunologists will produce many antibodies against philosophy. I mean, that was the idea of the paper. I think that was a failure in the sense that, you know, but it also showed me the kind of expectations that scientists had and the kind of ways I could really go around that kind of carefulness or skepticism, and so I think those kind of failures are very important. So sorry, it's a very scientific failure, not something of my life, but I think that was very important for me to realize that the kind of people I wanted to work with and on and in and, you know, were resistant to the kind of things, or could be resistant to the kind of things I was trying to do.
So the other way around, what is an achievement that you're particularly proud of?
I think it's very much at the institutional level. I think I really spent so many years trying to build those interactions between philosophy and science. I did that in Paris and was part of, curricula that were created and that really mixed philosophy and science. So we had this double licence, so sort of B curriculum in philosophy and science. I mean, that was important. And then coming to Bordeaux and being able to build that kind of philosophy in biology and medicine network, I mean, that I take as my main achievement. Also because I think that my own work, is not that important in the sense that it's just one example of something you can do when you put together philosophy and immunology. But I do think that it is more important for me to open up avenues, new doors, and new possibilities for other people who, for example, would say, oh, I'm not interested at all in immunology, but I want to do the same kind of things with another domain of biology and medicine. So I would say this is my main achievement. And now it's being recognized by, for example, by the CNRS, because we are an international research network. So I think that kind of work in the end pays in the sense that people realize that this exists. And nothing would make me more happy than having some biologists who just find out about this network and say, oh, I didn't know those things existed, and now I want to collaborate with philosophers or with another scientist who is going to do some more foundational thinking work, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, this is the kind of thing I would like to see during the rest of my career. That would be great.
So find me a philosopher of parasitology.
I tried already. It's.
I know. We're gonna get there. So we're gonna start to wrap up because I know your time is very precious. So, what advice would you give to yourself if you met Thomas 20 years ago?
Again, it's a very good question. I would say. Despite the obstacles, be as critical as possible. So we're going back to this. I think being critical is absolutely central. If we want to make progress, we have to constantly accept the idea that the way we do things might be good, but it might also not be the best way. And I think one thing that we philosophers and sort of basic scientists, I mean, what we can do, I think, is to say, let's constantly, of course, not 100% of our time, but let's keep always 15, 20% of our time to think differently. So I would say to the young Thomas, do that more, even more than you think you're doing already. And keep in mind that even though the obstacles are going to be strong, like some scientists will react negatively, and continue this, because indeed, in the end, this is what remains. In the end, if you're just participating in something which is very incremental, you just participate in philosophy the way it's already done, you participate in science the way it is already done, it's not going to be, very satisfactory. So I would say I'm very much of a revolutionary, to be honest. And of course, it fails because you cannot create revolutions everywhere and all the time. I just think that this is what makes me happy, when the small revolutions I've tried to do have some impact. So I would say, be even more revolutionary than you are. That is a very general advice, but I would say something like that.
I love that. So
love it too. So we are going to start to wrap up. So one question, so people can find out more about yourself. Where can people look for you and your work?
So it's very easy to find us on the web, of course. If people use any search engine, they will find us with the ImmunoConcept name of the lab, and also fillinbiomed.org has its own website. So all this is very easy to find on the web, and I guess this is the best entry point. And then we are super happy with my colleagues to answer all emails. Clearly, as I said before, we cannot be part of more projects than we are part of already, but if people are interested, we can contribute to connect them to other people. So yeah, we are easy to find on the internet, and we are happy to help if people are interested.
So thanks, Thomas. This has been great. And I'm a convert to the philosophy in biology idea. And I've tried to host philosophers in the lab. And it was great to have you for our listeners. Is there anything you'd like to add? Any closing remarks?
No, it's been a great discussion. I mean it. I really like what you're doing. And I think that we definitely, you know, in addition to the connection between philosophy and science, I definitely think that we need to think more about what science is, what science is, where it goes, and how it interacts with society in general. So I really appreciated our discussion. And I really think that this Lonely Pipette will have a long life, and congrats for what you're doing.
Yay! Thank you so much, Thomas. It was really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us at the Lonely Pipette.
We hope that you learned something new, that something resonated with your own experiences, or that you just enjoyed the science.
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter at Lonely Pipette, and please share it with your friends in the lab. If you want to join our community, you can subscribe to the Lonely Pipette mailing list or mail us by following the link available on our Twitter profile. You will receive the next episodes directly in your mailbox. How cool is that?
Stay tuned for the next show, and remember, you might feel like a lonely pipette, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Tips from the Lonely Pipette can help you to do better science.
A bientôt!
A bientôt!